We'll call a meeting to order. Chris tells me that we had a quorum and then one of our members left, but nonetheless we're still at a quorum. So Representative Hoppe, having reviewed thoroughly the minutes of the last meeting, we'll move the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Davids will move. Actually, we've got to take the committee report up on Representative Mahoney, House File 927. The chair will move that House File 927's committee report be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Davids moves that House File 927 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for moving my bill. There's two ways to do this. This is
The way we like it, Representative Mahoney. So
this is a good bill. It's a department bill. There is no controversy in the bill. I would ask for your vote, or I can explain it.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Is there anyone that desires to be heard with respect to House File 927? Is there any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative David renews his motion that House File 927 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Appreciate your time today.
Mr.
Next up is, which one are we going to do second? We were going to do Representative Kalin's bill, but he's not in the room. Unless he's...
Move the table.
Oh, you're quick, Representative Zeller. We'll go on. Representative Lane is... come on down, Representative Lane, if you're around. Galsey, Representative... Oh, there's Representative Lane right there. The chair will move that House File 420. Committee report be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Chair will move that House File 420 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Okay. Representative Lane, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very simple. Homeowners now have an implied warranty, and as I say, they need to know that the warranty's in those books back there, and most of them don't even know they exist. They don't get an actual written warranty, and they can choose to waive their protection that they may not know exactly what that is. So we're just saying that they can't waive them and that they will provide a written, real warranty by requiring the builder to actually convey this in writing to them. I believe it's a simple matter. We've gone round and round, and I guess we've come to the agreement that it actually is. So that's what it is.
Thank you, Representative Lane. So this just requires that they get a copy of the statute.
Basically, yes.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lane, on page 1, line 1.22 of the bill, what does express warranties mean? I mean, what is there a legal term for express warranties as compared to a regular warranty?
I will ask
Representative Lane, or I see you've got to phone a friend. If you'll just identify who you are and proceed with the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Fred Jacoberger. I'm an attorney. I live at 2701 Overlook Drive in Bloomington, and I represent homeowners in construction defect suits. Yes, express warranty means a real warranty, a warranty that's not implied in law or implied in fact, one that's real. We're simply asking that the warranty provisions that are already required by law be included in new home construction purchase agreements so that the homeowners know there is a warranty. In fact, many contractors, in my experience, are doing this already. We just want to make it a common practice.
Sir, could you, there was a little bit of noise when you were saying your last name. Could you repeat your
last name? Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Fred, and the last name is Jacoberger, Jacoberger.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess thank you for the answer to your question, and I'm new on this committee, and maybe I'm just not getting it, but why do we need the word express? Does that, if the word express wasn't in there and it said provide substitute warranties, would that do the same thing?
I haven't considered the word substitute. I think the use of the word express is to change from a statutory warranty, which is a warranty implied in law, to a warranty that's now going to be given directly from the contractors to the homeowners by virtue of their agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Jacoberger. Representative Hoppe, anything further on this?
No, Mr. Chair.
I know that Ms. Frenette signed up to testify. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. I'm Alicia Frenette with the Builders Association of Minnesota.
We agree, and we've talked to several people and contractors that are getting the warranty statute put in with their contracts. However, we have a problem with the term express. Express defined in the dictionary or in the legal dictionary says that, say you own a toaster, you buy a toaster. Your kid ruins the toaster, you don't get a new toaster. But if your toaster doesn't toast, you get a new one, and your express warranty says that that's what you get for it. In an express warranty for home building, it would allow the builder to put some of their own terms and negotiate terms for the warranty. In this situation, we're not allowed to. We'd like to see the word express removed.
Thank you, Ms. Burnett. Mr. Hopkins, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who this, maybe this question is for Mr. Pender. If we look at page 3 of the bill, 3.23 and 3.25, the word explicit is in there. And on page 1, I asked earlier about the word express warranties. On page 3, we have explicit written warranties. Is there a legal distinction there? And is this, I mean, I guess I'm just wondering, express, explicit, where are we? Is there a reason for that?
Ms. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, the way I'd explain express is that the warranties are actually expressed in the contract. They're actually there that you can read them. They're expressed by the contractor. Explicit. I don't really know what that adds if you say explicit written warranty. I'm not really sure what the word explicit adds there if it's already in writing. So I don't have an opinion or an explanation of what the word explicit adds there, except I think probably in preparing this bill, it was probably meant as a sort of a word of emphasis that this is an explicit written warranty. But I don't view it as meaning exactly the same thing as express warranty.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have to say I feel a lot better about not knowing why it's explicit in there if Mr. Pender doesn't know. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not an attorney, but what if we took the word express and the words explicit out? Would it change the bill? Would it do anything? I know Ms. Frenette would be happier. Legally, does it do anything one way or the other?
And let's ask Mr. Pender. Is he, and specifically, Representative Hoppe, where are you looking to? I see one reference to explicit.
On line 1.22 is the word express, which is already in statute. And then on page 3 of the new language, lines 3.23, explicit, and 3.25, it says explicit also. And it might say it somewhere else that I haven't seen yet, but that's...
Ms. Bennett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, I think the word express is still needed in 1.22. That's original. That's existing language and talks about the contractor providing substitute express warranties to replace the statutory warranty. So I think if the word express weren't there, then it's not clear how the contractor is substituting warranties. In other words, I think the clear idea of this is that they're supposed to be actually expressed by the contractor in writing, and it says that if they do that, they can offer substantially the same protections. So I think the word express probably should stay in the existing law just as it is, and I think that's a different issue than whether explicit is included in the new language.
But in 3.23 and 3.25, Mr. Pender, that use of the word explicit in addition to use of the word written doesn't seem to accomplish a great deal.
I agree with that, Mr. Chair.
Representative David?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the person that testified that didn't like it, the word express, that's current law.
Right.
Could she come down?
Ms. Burnett is like a contestant on The Price is Right. She's coming on down. She's going to come back with a new...
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Burnett
Representative David.
You mentioned that you didn't like the word express in there, I believe, and that's already there. That doesn't mean you have to like it.
Ms. Frenette, my guess is that you were referencing the word explicit rather than, because express is already current law. You have some heartburn about using the word explicit together with written.
That does give us heartburn, you're right.
Okay. We should ask, I'm sorry, but, Ms. Frenette.
However, and just let me read this book because I haven't looked at this in a few minutes, for a few minutes.
While she's looking at that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
So in current statute, if someone offers the substitute express warranty, is that just in the contract that they're signing saying there's a warranty on this? Just letting them know in writing that there is a warranty without giving them a copy of the statute? And I'm not trying to change this. I was just curious of the difference between explicit and express, and maybe this is the wrong committee for it. Maybe I just have to remain confused. Well, but
and I appreciate your ask. This is the second time in two meetings I've been asked questions of bills that aren't even mine. But under current law, it just says that you can't change or modify unless you substitute an express warranty. That's lines 1.21 and 1.22.
Right.
That simply means that you say it out loud, that you, or you put it in writing, that there's no implication, there's no, it's not hidden in any fashion, it's stated out loud. So that's, I think, pretty good language the way that it is. But the issue in terms of the bill that's before us is whether or not we need both explicit and written, and we've had similar issues regarding homeowner warranty bills where it has not been terribly clear afterwards what our intent was. And to use two words that essentially mean the same thing, and I think, not essentially, I mean they are. My preference would be that we take out the word explicit as well, because otherwise we're sending a message that, you know, what was the legislature seeking to do by using the term explicit and the word written when the one is the same as the other? But Ms. Frenette, we've given you a chance to review it.
May I offer something?
Please do.
Davis, when you look at the lines 1.21 through 1.23, which talks about the express warranties, the substitute express warranty is a warranty above the warranty statutes that are currently offered in 327A, which means the builder would offer something more than is already offered under the current warranty. So they build stuff in. They would build stuff into the contract or their own warranty. That's where it would become an express warranty. Again, the builder would be offering something more than is what currently, that's why express is, I believe why express is in there at that point. It offers something more than just the warranty statute that's out there. We've got 327A is the home warranty statute. It's implied. We want to hand that over. In these sentences, I see where the builder is offered to offer something higher than is already in current statute.
Let's come back to the new language of the bill. This is it's an educational discussion relative to existing law. But Representative Lane, do you have a point?
If it feels more comfortable to take out the duplicative explicit in those two lines, that's fine. I agree with the chair around the use of express, because here on line 1.22 it says provide substitute express warranties. It doesn't say anything that makes any difference on the word express.
Yeah, and let's leave page one alone. That's existing law. But the chair will move then on lines 3.23 and 3.25 that the word explicit be removed. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. We now have the bill in the shape that appears more comfortable to the committee. Are there other questions or concerns? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 420 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Kalin in the room? Actually, well, you missed your chance a little. We'll take you up right next. We've got Representative Scalzi who was called for. That is House File 330. The chair will move that the committee report on House File 330 be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. The chair will move that House File 330 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Scalzi, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Yes, it is nice to be back. I had this bill here last year, and it passed, and it was headed for the floor, but we had a little trouble with the Senate. So we're back again this year, and my bill is a two-word change regarding the homeowner warranty contract. And as everybody would agree, we want to have our homeowners who have a problem with their warranty, we would like to have them contact their builders immediately, because we want to take care of these problems immediately if possible. This bill, House File 330, changes the word 6 months to 1 year. And the reason for that is because in Minnesota weather, we sometimes have problems that may show up during the rainy season or during the freeze and thaw season. We might see a tiny bit of condensation, maybe don't think it's a problem, but we have noticed it. And all of a sudden, 6 months, 9 months later, we see a larger piece of condensation on a window or something like that after the rainy season and the freeze and thaw. So this would just give the homeowner a little bit longer time to contact the contractor. And I have with me as well Mr. Fred Jacoberger, who is an attorney who has worked on these types of issues before.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi. Mr. Jacoberger, anything to my understanding from the builders is that they don't necessarily oppose this provision. They kind of wonder why a homeowner would want to wait an additional 6 months to bring a claim, but the seasonal issue is a good point. Mr. Jacoberger, with that understanding, if you have comments that you can keep as brief as possible, we'd appreciate it.
I have nothing further to add, Mr. Chairman.
That's excellent, Mr. Jacoberger. Thank you for your comments. Ms. Burnett is listed on the list of folks that want to testify. Ms. Burnett, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Lisa Burnett with the Builders Association of Minnesota, and I don't think I could have said it any more succinctly than the chair did. We're not opposing it, but we think that it's just a dangerous move on the builders or the homeowners' part, and it could allow for a problem to exacerbate.
Thank you, Ms. Burnett. Are there questions or comments or anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to House File 330? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 330 be recommended pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Seeing there are a few opposed, but the motion prevails nonetheless. Thank you very much,
thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Scalzi. Next up is House File 1532. Representative Kalin's bill. The chair will move that House File 1532 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Welcome.
Greetings, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your flexibility.
My understanding, Representative Kalin, you have an A1 amendment. Is that right?
I do have an A1 thoughts amendment.
I'm looking. It's being distributed as we speak. I will move that. We won't vote on it until people actually have that in their possession. So the chair will move the A1 amendment, and as soon as it's distributed, we'll put the bill in the shape that the author desires to proceed with it. But with that, I think it's safe to say it will pass, Representative Kalin. So if you want to speak to the bill as amended, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and members, I will be brief. House File 1532 is brought to us by the Secretary of State to do some cleanup on their business practices legislation, and with me to discuss the goals of the bill and be available to answer questions is Mr. Bert Black from the Secretary of State's office.
Okay. Ms. Black,
thank
welcome.
You, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Kalin, my name is Bert Black, legal advisor to the Office of the Secretary of State. And this bill is really the product of our professional staff who have been working on a project to make our business filings online, and in the course of that, they have been very diligent in finding places where we can streamline. Generally speaking, most of this bill is focused on three areas. The first area is when a non-Minnesota corporation, limited liability company, or limited partnership comes to Minnesota, they have to file with us a certificate from the home state. In practice, everybody goes to the home state. Often it's Delaware, sometimes California, Nevada. They go to the home state for all the records. So we're talking about really a penalty, a fee that the company has to pay to another state. We're just saying in many of these sections that they simply need to declare that they've complied and indicate any information that's changed, like their name. Another set of sections in this bill refers to the 545.05, which is the Bogus Filing Expedited Review Act. Bogus filings are liens that are put on very often elected officials. The governor's had one on them, the first lady, various legislators. And we did a law in 2005 to combat that. There was an unpublished opinion that recently the Jewell case that narrowed this very, very greatly beyond the scope. And we've been working with the Attorney General's office and private practitioners in the UCC area, and sections 21 to 27 take care of that problem. The third area is in your author's, in the author's amendment, and is what makes the A1 amendment rather long, and that is for name protection. We had a situation earlier this year where a name squatter decided that they were going to file legally for the names of St. Olaf College, Augsburg College, iMation, Ecolab, and a couple of other large institutions. The names were available because those organizations hadn't filed their annual renewal. We've been working with the Bar Association for a solution to that. Our solution is in the A1 amendment and is basically we're going to put a placeholder when a company is dissolved for 12 months, and that will hold the name for them so that they can reinstate. Reinstatement can be done at almost any time after the dissolution. This takes care of their name, to hold their name. It's good for the organizations. There are some other changes that are similar, streamlining changes in the bill. They are detailed, and I think you have the a narrative bill summary along with a section-by-section summary. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Black. And is there anyone else here to testify with respect to this bill? We then have the A1 amendment before us to put it in the shape with which the author would like to proceed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the A1 amendment is passed. Then to the bill, are there questions or concerns with respect to the Secretary of State's bill? Seeing none, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 1532 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kalin. Thank you, Mr. Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney, we'll move House File 1463 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance, apparently, is where you get to make a visit.
I'm looking forward to...
I thought you might be, with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Dabney, it's my understanding there's an A1 amendment that is yours. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
So Representative Dabney will move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Dabney, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, have we seen that amendment?
That's the way we like to do it, Representative Hoppe.
I'm sure it's a fine amendment. So.
Why don't...
He's not ashamed of it, Mr.
Chair. I'll tell you.
Let him go.
You know what? You're doing a fine job today, Representative Hoppe. Well, I'm just going to keep talking, though, until it's distributed to you so that we don't have to undo the motion. If you'd like, Representative Hoppe, we'll undo the motion. Otherwise, I think what we'll do is we'll have the author speak to it as amended.
Excellent.
And
idea.
If you have a problem with it, we'll go back to the amendments and possibly do a little redo.
I only have solutions.
Absolutely, Representative Hoppe. Representative Dabney and Mr. Black, to the bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Hoppe, this really is a technical amendment changing some effective dates, a few things like that. My understanding from the Office of Secretary of State is not a substantive amendment. I do appreciate your bringing up the issue.
I just thought I lost it.
No, we kept it from you.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, members, you just heard Representative Kalin's bill, also from the Secretary of State's office. These two are joined, and this is kind of the second half of that. There is some minor fiscal impact to this bill. Some fees are being raised, some decreased, but that is not why it is in front of this committee. It's because this deals with the business end of the Secretary of State's responsibilities. With me this evening is Mr. Black, who can speak to it far better than I.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Mr. Black, welcome back. I don't think you ever actually even left the chair, but if you want to proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I didn't get a chance to get up. Mr. Chair and members, this is the half of our agency bill that has some fiscal impact. We're doing a number of things. About half the sections streamline the annual renewal sections in our business statutes. We've created a new section that takes all, centralized all the requirements and taken them out of the chapter by chapter sections in corporation law and the limited liability company law, so that all these annual renewals can be the same and can be programmed the same in our computer rewrite, and that's important. There's another section that extends the temporary technology surcharge that is in place right now. That is something that is supported by the State Bar Association. We're changing assumed name filings, which are generally filed by partnerships and sole proprietorships. I think they've been around for 120 years. They've been on a 10-year duration. Now we're changing them to be like all the other business filings, where it's perpetual with an annual renewal. And that's going to wind up reducing their fees over the long term. We've got some sections on the central notification system that deals with farm products. Similarly, we're going to have a change in the fees so that terminations, which are very important to farmers, are filed more frequently. We're also making our the fees internally consistent. We're trying to make establish the sort of a price point of $35 for name reservations, $50 for the limited partnership miscellaneous filings. We're going to change our global filing provision so that it's better able to be done online. We're going to start formally collecting email addresses as the contacts for businesses. We're going to allow for people who file, we have the notary function as well. Right now you can't get a refund if you overpay us. You can't get a refund unless you ask for it. We're going to proposing to change the law so that we can just send you your overpayment back. And finally, we're going to allow people to allow non-Minnesota businesses to withdraw more easily from doing business in the state in a way that makes it, frankly, better for them, easier for them to come back later on. So that's the bill. And again, it's generally a streamlining bill. Comes out of the professional staff suggestions for how to make our computer rewrite more effective, more consistent, and easier for the public to use when it gets online.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Is there anyone else here that desires to testify with respect to this highly controversial bill? Representative Zellers?
Well, Mr. Chairman, see, most of the stuff in here is pretty uncontroversial. The only tiny little section that gives me a little bit of concern is on page 2. It says email addresses collected by the Secretary of State pursuant to this section may must not be provided as false data. I'm just making sure, Mr. Chairman, we had a little bit of a problem with this before. I'm just making sure that collection purposes and email addresses, we're not getting afoul on some of this stuff. So if Mr. Black can give me comfort there, I'm assuming it'll be non-controversial.
Our reason for putting that in was a concern that somebody would ask for purchase. You know, this is all public data. All the business data is public data. It's not appropriate. We're trying to collect these email addresses and encourage the use of that with our office because, frankly, the postal rates are going up next month. It's getting more expensive to do printing and postage. So we're trying to use emails. We don't want somebody to be able to call us up and ask us, you know, we want your entire list of email addresses because, frankly, that's just going to lead to something like, I guess it'd be spam. It used to be, when it was phone numbers, it would have been cold calling to people to see if they wanted to invest in something. We don't want to do that. We want to make it possible. If somebody wants to contact a company, a specific company, they can ask for that specific company, and we'll give them that email address because that is public data. And the company has the option of giving us any email address they want. So if they don't want to be, if the president of the company doesn't want to be contacted, he can give us the lawyer's email, or he can give us, there are many registered agent companies. But we don't want to have somebody asking to buy the whole list because we know from experience back in the 80s that's just going to lead to people getting spammed and they're going to get a lot of annoying emails, and that we don't want that.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Representative Zellers, comfortable? Comfortable enough?
I think so, Mr. Chairman, as long as the Secretary of State isn't the sole keeper of these addresses, I think we'll be just fine.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Are there other questions or comments? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Black, I'm looking at the fees on page 18. I know you talked a little bit about that in your summary of the bill. But to me, this looks like just a straight fee increase. Can you give a little comment on that?
Mr. Black?
Yes, so thank you for asking that question. If you look at that, and it's a little complicated, if you look at page 18, line 16, there is a fee increase in 12 and 14. And the reason for that is to make up the lost revenue from 16. Line 16 provides that we will no longer charge. We're currently charging a $20 fee for a termination statement. This is by the way, this is in the farm lien central notification system. And the central notification system, if a lender files the farm product buyer, the grain elevator, cannot issue a check only to the farmer. They have to issue a joint check to the farmer and the lender. The lender is supposed to file a termination when the loan has been repaid, and then if that happens, then the farmer gets the check all by themselves. They don't have to go down to the bank. So what's happening here is we have calculated based on the current volumes of terminations and original CNS filings. If we take out the termination statement but add $5 to the original filing, that is revenue neutral, but it will encourage the filing of the terminations. And I will say that we have worked with both Farm Credit Services and the Minnesota Bankers Association and ICBM, the community bankers, and none of them have any objections to these provisions. They think it's a deal.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Any other questions or concerns? If not, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 1463 as amended be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion prevails. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Folks, next up we're going to do Representative Saylor's bill, and then Representative Knuth will be after that. The chair will move that House File 569 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Saylor, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, if someone would like to move this bill, I'm ready to
move
to it.
I'm sorry,
I was in such a hurry, I didn't even hear that. At any rate, I will very briefly just go through the summary. It's a pilot project implemented from September 1 to June 30th by the paint industry to manage post-consumer paint. Paint industry and government partners will examine all management costs and methods in Minnesota for the demonstration project to allow the marketplace to determine the best practices and efficiencies. What the bill does, it relieves much of local government's financial burden for paint management and disposal, and it gets counties out of the business of paint disposal. It makes it easier for Minnesota residents and painting contractors to dispose of leftover unwanted architectural paint, promotes reuse recycling of paint, is a cost-effective collection, transportation, reuse, and recycling method, internalizes paint management costs into the price of paint, is the creation of a not-for-profit third-party organization to manage this pilot project, has a state antitrust exemption, and will provide information for national paint management programs and create a national level playing field for the manufacturers and others involved with paint. There is oversight and review and plan approval by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, with reporting requirements that include independent financial audits and costs avoided by government. What the bill does not do, it does not add costs to the state or to local government. It does not require any retail stores to take back paint. That's totally voluntary, a business decision for those stores. And it does not remove the existing hazardous programs that are still needed for other things. I have a number of people in the audience who are not going to testify unless there's some question. They're just here for those purposes. And I do have with me a representative from the Minnesota Paint and Wall Covering Employers Association, Mr. John Nessie, who would just like to very briefly speak to the committee, and we can move on.
Mr. Nesky, I think, let me ask you, this Representative Taylor, it appears to me, based on what's in the bill and what's no longer in the bill, that you heard the concerns that were raised. Some of the members here are new, but are you aware of any opposition to the bill anymore?
No, sir, I am not.
And is there anybody here in the audience here today here to testify against the bill? All right, Mr. Nesky, don't mess this up.
I like it.
We support it. You are welcome any time, Mr. Nesky. Are there questions, concerns, or comments from members of the committee? Otherwise, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Taylor, do we know what this fee will be?
Representative Taylor.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the whole question.
How much is this, what is the fee going to be?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, that will be determined by the pilot project itself. We did not want to put a cap on it because we were concerned that that might actually lead to sort of artificially setting a cap where we could get by with a smaller amount. And so that will be determined by the pilot project itself.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, so what exactly would the fee pay for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the fee pays for all the costs of the paint disposal, the financial audit that I mentioned earlier, and all costs regarding this paint stewardship project, the pilot project.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, so Representative Taylor, does that include, you know, staffing? Are they going to be having an office that they're going to be paying rent for? What all does that include?
Representative Taylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that requires, it will pay for the minimum amount necessary to do this project. It is not a money-making endeavor by any means, and with the oversight provided by the MPCA, they will be watching this as it moves along to be sure that there are not any extraneous costs being built in.
Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Taylor on line 2.21 starts in there, the paint stewardship assessment must be included in the cost of all architectural paint sold to Minnesota retailers, distributors, and each Minnesota retailer distributor must include the assessment in the purchase price of all architectural paint. We're saying they must include it, but we don't know how much. I guess this is kind of the round and round we got going with last time, and I just figured that since we had an idea of the main concern about this bill last time was the fees, how much it was going to cost. Because let's face it, it's not going to be the manufacturers, it's not going to be the counties, it's going to be the consumers. The people who are trying to paint their bedroom, their house, whatever, are going to have to pay for this. So I just think it begs the question, we've been around this issue, how do we know how much it's going to cost? And if we're going to reinvent the wheel again, in a different way, I think you have an idea of what it's going to cost, and I just would like to get on the record how much. It was 50 cents before, now we're not sure. And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Zeller. First thing I would like to make very clear is that at no point will anyone be paying twice for the disposal of the same thing. And, you know, we will pay for the disposal of paint one time, not twice, so it's not any sort of double situation going on here. And the reason that they are not, setting that fee is because we believe that there is greater opportunity actually for that number to go down rather than to go up. And as I understand it, Mr. Nesky actually wanted to speak to you about that.
Mr. Nesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the risk of extending my testimony too far here, I thought I'd add that as contractors, the group I represent, it's their biggest concern the cost of paint would go up. And I think that because this is an industry-driven program, which we will be participating in, which the manufacturers will be participating in, there is going to be sufficient pressure to keep that fee contained. And we're comfortable with that as tremendous purchasers of paint, and I hope the consumers would be too.
Well, Representative Zeller.
Mr. Chairman, no offense, but you're not going to be the one paying for it. Your customers will. And if it's going to add to the amount of whatever we're charging, you know, for three bedrooms and a bathroom, again, on behalf of the consumers, I'm sure as an industry this is a good idea because it's just you're just passing it through. And I just think that before you're going to do this to a consumer, you should have an idea of what it's going to cost. And I understand, Mr. Chairman, I'm not smart, but I understand we're not going to get an amount. But I can say this, Mr. Chair, if at some point during this process we don't get an idea of how much it is, I don't see how this is any different, because in the end, I'm sure a lot of the folks, whether they be the manufacturers, the distributors, they're not going to be paying for it. They're going to be passing it through to the customers. Whether it's 50 cents a can, 10 cents a can, it's being passed through the consumers. That's my concern here, not necessarily, no offense to you folks in the industry, but my main goal here is to make sure that the consumer knows how much more it's going to cost them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think that's a good reason why it's being piloted as opposed to... Oh, but Representative Anderson had a question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Saylor, do you have a fiscal note, since MPCA will be the ones that will be in charge of monitoring this and how much this will cost to their residents?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, a fiscal note is not required because this is part of the normal task that the Product Stewardship Division of the MPCA actually does. So a special fiscal note is not required.
Representative Kuhl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I just want to be clear. Right now, counties are paying to dispose of paint through property taxes, I'd assume, to the tune of $4 million a year, it looks like. And that's perhaps a way we could help ease our local government budgets a little bit and have the people using a product deal with it rather than every single property taxpayer in a county. Do you want to comment on that? Or
I think you just did.
I just wanted to point it out to members. We are paying for this.
It's an excellent point.
Sure you want
to. Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to ask the same question that Representative Knuth did. If people are currently paying this, and now we're going to pay when we buy paint, and the money goes to a private group, what happens to the money that we're currently paying?
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, actually this kind of refers to my earlier comment about at no point will the same gallon of paint ever be paid the same disposal cost. Counties actually are spending about $5 million annually to manage this paint, and counties actually have about a difference of about $41.9 million that they are spending on other things in solid waste management, and so when they do not have to pay for the paint disposal, they will use that for the other pieces that they are already required to do to fund.
Representative Hoppe, final comment, and we're going to move the bill.
Well, and thank you, Representative Saylor. So when we have a letter here from Carver County that says they're going to estimate their savings at $70,000 a year, that's approximately what they're paying right now for disposing of paint at the county.
Representative Saylor, a final word.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, I'm not completely conversant with everything that Carver County has, but if that's what they said, that's what they're expecting to see in savings.
Thank you, Representative Saylor. A good, healthy discussion. House File 569, with the Chair will renew his motion that House File 569 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Saylor. Thank you, Mr. Nessie. Representative Knuth will move her bill, which is House File 362, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the committee. You know what? We've got a committee report that we should do first. Representative, well, the chair will move that House File 362's committee report be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Knuth will then move that House File 362 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Knuth, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I think you're receiving the committee engrossment right now. I'm assuming that's what the pages are passing out. Yes?
And
no.
Well, wait, just hang on one second. We want to make sure that we've got the actual correct engrossment. Okay. Folks, we have, and Representative Knuth, since you're on the committee, unfortunately you get to sit back down for a moment. We've got the bill as introduced rather than the first committee engrossment.
Mr. Chair, I was trying to get that fixed, and so...
And it's on its way,
okay.
For members' sake, we want to make sure you're working off the right version of the bill, and apparently there was a little bit of tinkering that happened to the bill on its way to us, so we want to make sure that we have the correct version in front of us. So I'm just, we're going to have to lay this bill over temporarily, not very long, just to make sure that we get it's a short bill, fortunately, so it won't take too long to get a correct copy of it. Thank you for your understanding. Next up, I believe I saw Representative Dill. Representative Dill has got House File 1406. And the chair will move that House File 1406 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Dill, it's my understanding there is an A1 amendment, and that is an author's amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
The chair will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape with which the author would like to proceed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Dill, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill is actually a tax bill regarding charitable gambling. It greatly simplifies the way charitable gambling taxes are collected. In full disclosure, I am involved with a charitable organization that pays a considerable amount of tax and have interest in this for my organization as well as many others. Right now, the bill changes it to a flat tax on the gross profit of all five forms of legal gambling, where presently there are five forms of legal gambling, of which there are four different taxes. So it's complicated and hard to deal with. It also makes the current system of pull tab taxes and tip boards on gross receipts. So the organization, right now, they're paying taxes whether they play the game or not, or regardless of the amount of receipts that they receive. A couple other things it does is eliminates the pull tab and tip board tax, which has to do with the unsold ticket tax, has the unsold tickets that we pay tax on now up front. When you buy a game from a distributor, such as a pull tab game, causes a big cash flow problem. You can't get a refund on the unsold tickets until February. Actually, you file the return in February.
Yeah.
And it does a few other technical items, and if you have any questions about the bill, Mr. Wilson is here from the Allied Charities, and he would be more than glad to get into the very technical issues of the bill and how it does it. The bill actually, members, as drafted, would save charities or put back into your community when they make their lawful purpose distributions about $22.5 million into the state of Minnesota's communities, and less $22.5 million less taxes that the state collects. Now, I obviously understand that we are in a money crunch and that this money goes to the general fund. So there's a bill that's going to be coming here shortly, I believe in today's committee, that if passed and they run on a similar track would earn a considerable amount, if not all of that money back as well. And that's a bill that the chair is, Chair Atkins is authoring. So, Mr. Chair, I stand for questions, and we also have Mr. Wilson here to answer any questions. Should you have any?
Thank you, Representative Dill. Are you aware of any opposition to the House File 1406?
No.
Is there anybody here today that desires to testify in opposition to House File 1406? And I know that there's an amendment, Representative Zellers. For purposes of this committee, our purview is not with respect to the tax rate per se, but to the policy associated with streamlining and making the tax situation much more straightforward. If you oppose a straightforward tax system, I guess you can speak for that. But otherwise, I'm going to turn to Representative Zellers, who has what's been titled the B1 amendment. Representative Zellers, you move the B1 amendment?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
You speak to it?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Court Holton is here as well. But this is a bill relating to pari-mutuel wagers and horse tracks, and I'll let Mr. Colton explain the quick version, and then we move on to a vote, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Mr. Holton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, several years ago, the federal government changed the Interstate Horse Racing Act with reference to televised signals and electronic transfer and they ended up making basically internet-type wagering legal. Now, we don't do it in Minnesota because we have the off-track betting restriction. So you can't in Minnesota, you can't sit here and activate Canterbury, for instance, from your house. But it's done in other states, and we send our signal out for simulcasting purposes. That televised signal gets into the hands of other vendors who integrate it into their internet systems and use our races. They use our televised signals of our races in their systems, sort of like pirating our product. Now, we have talked to them, the bigger ones, and they were willing to compensate us like they compensate racetracks in other states, except officials in Minnesota have said before that it's not clear whether they're able to compensate us. So right now, we're getting nothing for these races, and a lot of Minnesota money is going out of state. This amendment would clarify that they can pay us for what they've taken, and if they don't, we can go after them. Right now, we can do nothing but sit here and watch that money go out the window.
Thank you, Mr. Holt. Representative Zellers, anything further to the amendment?
Just trying to do my part to help balance the budget, Mr. Chairman.
Representative David?
Mr. Chairman, I would move an amendment on line 6 to correct the spelling on mutual. Or is that correct somehow? I've never seen it spelled that way.
Actually,
is that a new type of racing?
Mr. McCormick, I've seen it spelled both ways. And in Representative Zeller's world, you know, you're lucky you didn't use an O rather than an A. But
well, I got horses. Right. I mean, that's the important part, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, that's one of the alternative spellings of the word paramutual, and so it's acceptable, but
Chairman, I'll withdraw my amendment.
Thank you for being so attentive, though, Representative David. Are there any objections to the amendment? Otherwise, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. Any other comments, questions with respect to the bill? Otherwise, I intend to renew my motion, but it will be a different motion. With the amendment, you need to make a quick pit stop in the Civil Law Committee. So the chair will renew his motion that House File 1406 be recommended to pass as amended and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Beal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. And Representative Beal, you're up next as well with regard to House File 993. The chair will move that House File 993 be recommended to pass. Representative Beal, to your bill.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill raises the threshold for audit requirements on nonprofits. And with me today I have Mr. Carl Peterson, who is the past chair of the Minnesota CPA Society. The present chair couldn't be here today to testify in favor of the bill because of a family health issue that emerged. So Mr. Peterson was kind enough to come and pinch hit here, and he has some very brief testimony to add to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Beal. Mr. Peterson,
thank
welcome.
You. Very brief. The impact on the nonprofits, this is a kind of a short, very brief summary, but moving that threshold to $750,000 would save, you know, thousands of dollars for these organizations, probably $5,000 to $10,000 a year in audit fees, preserving their working capital for ongoing services and programs of the organization, and enhance the organization's financial position. And consider the nonprofit that receives in-kind non-cash contributions. For example, the Builders Outreach Foundation, which works in the Frogtown area of St. Paul, building and providing affordable housing, it partners with the City of St. Paul and other nonprofit organizations. Much of that revenue is from in-kind non-cash donations, such as doors, windows, materials, and labor. Doing more than one home per year often puts them over the audit threshold. They're not a cash-rich organization. It's better for them to do only one home per year, so they have the capability to do more, but the annual audit fees do not justify more than one project per year. The organization does not suffer, but the Frogtown community and its residents suffer. You may also be aware that there's a new 990 requirement for organizations that provide more accountability as well.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Are there questions or concerns for the author or for Mr. Peterson? Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the witness, Mr. Peterson. Are the CPA statewide organizations okay with this? I mean, it looks like they're in lose some business here.
No, we are okay with it. I've had emails from other firms in Duluth and locally that support this.
Representative Davis, anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
I don't have to talk about the CPA.
You know what? You don't ever want to tick off a CPA.
No.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Especially the one doing your taxes, I guess. Representative Bill?
I think that what they will save on the threshold increase, they will pay back on the requirements of the new 990 that they'll be filing, because it's much more comprehensive and more detailed. And so I think the CPAs are very likely to kind of have a wash on their fees and things of that nature. Would that be accurate, Mr. Peterson? That's very accurate. The new requirements require much more detail and knowledge in performing the 990 preparation. And the consulting fees and everything with that will come back to the CPA firm.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any other questions or concerns for anyone else who desires to testify with respect to House File 993? Seeing none, then the chair will renew his motion that House File 993 be recommended to pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bill. We have a couple of the chair's bills. I preferred not to do mine before other people's bills. Representative Anseltz, are you ready to go with respect to House File 1098? Representative Anseltz will move that House File 1098 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Anseltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1098 is the compulsive gambling legislation for the biennium. It will be a continuation of the appropriation from the Minnesota State Lottery Prize Fund to the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, who in turn will fund a grant to the Minnesota chapter of the National Council on Problem Gambling, which has been done for, I believe, four, perhaps five bienniums now. The Minnesota chapter is called the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance. The purpose of all of this is to increase public awareness, provide training for those who treat citizens affected by compulsive gambling, and to conduct research on compulsive gambling. And a last comment, you all know the stresses that the economy is having on the citizenry, and we're noticing a double-digit increase in stress-related compulsive gambling cases that are coming to the attention of authorities, not only in Minnesota, but throughout the country. So I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Anseltz. Is there anyone that desires to testify with respect to this? I know we have Mr. Feeney on the list probably to answer any questions, but is there any questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Anseltz will renew his motion that House File 1098 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Anseltz. Next up is House File 528. Representative Dabney, did this come out of the division, Representative Dabney, or was it?
Yes, it did, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Dabney will move the committee report. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Dabney, we will move House File 528 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Dabney, it's my understanding there's an author's A090147 amendment.
Actually, Mr. Chair, that has been replaced by the H528A101 amendment that I believe is being distributed by the pages at this time.
It is in my hands. Representative Dabney will move the H528A101 amendment. We will not vote on it until all members have it in their hands, so we'll come back to that. Representative Dabney, to the bill as in all likelihood it will be amended. So.
All right. Just briefly to the amendment, it demonstrates some movement towards compromise with members of the banking and mortgage banking communities between the Attorney General's office, myself, and them. So just changes some of the length of the rescission period and limits the provision on lender responsibility to just those that are not those reverse mortgages that are not federally insured. My apologies, members to the bill at large. Our seniors look usually to three legs of a stool to meet their needs as they get older: Social Security, whatever sort of a pension they may have from their previous employer, and investment income. What we know is under the current economic situation, that third leg of investment income is getting a whole lot shorter than the other two. That is creating many challenges for our seniors. We're looking through this to ensure that when our seniors look to a reverse mortgage, that it is one that is marketed to them appropriately and responsibly and is suitable to the borrower. With me today is Ms. Heil from the Attorney General's office, who can walk through the bill and assist with the technical questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Do you have testimony that you wish to provide, or are you just here to answer questions or concerns?
I can answer questions.
Okay. Then why don't we, let me ask this, with the amendment, is there any opposition to the bill?
Mr. Chair, we do have one supporter from AARP who's wishing to come down. In addition, Lucent Social Services in support of the bill. They, however, were not able to be here this evening due to other. Oh, you are. I'm sorry. It's a cast of thousands. If the bill is so popular.
Well, when you have a bill of this high quality,
please.
So this must be Ms. Stone.
Yes.
Representative Dabney, would you do me a favor and move the microphone? And
for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 528, legislation authored by Representative Divini to support House File, help protect consumers of reverse mortgages. I'm Christine Stone. I'm a volunteer of AARP grassroots election and advocacy team. AARP would like to thank Mr. Chair and Attorney General Lori Swanson for their leadership in bringing the legislation forward. Older Minnesotans have been among the hardest hit by the economic crisis. Many have lost their retirement savings and employment while struggling to pay the increasing cost of living. For most older Minnesotans, our home constitutes the biggest and most important part of our life savings. In fact, two-thirds of the Americans age 65 and older own their homes free and clear. In today's economic downturn, older homeowners across the state are increasingly turning to reverse mortgage to pay for life's necessities, such as needed home repairs, health care, and long-term care. AARP believes, in general, reverse mortgages should be used as a last resort for most consumers. We know that reverse mortgages can be a useful safety net for many Minnesotans who have no other choice and want to remain living independently. I would like to call your attention to several areas of this bill that we believe will have a positive protective impact on consumers. We support the suitability clause intended to ensure the reverse mortgages are sold only to people who need them. Lenders should be held responsible for selling loans that they know are bad for particular consumers. We also support the prohibition of cross-selling. Too often the home equity of borrowers is depleted because they are offered inappropriate financial products, such as annuities and long-term care insurance. Consumers should be wary of anyone who tries to sell them something to be paid for with a reverse mortgage. If anyone is trying to sell you something and recommending you use the reverse mortgage to pay it, that's generally a good sign that you shouldn't be buying it. We also support the mandatory counseling provision of the bill. I was the advocate for AARP when that first counseling bill was passed back in the early 1992. and we really support the added protections here. We're pleased that the time frame in which consumers can reconsider their loan is expanding. We're also pleased that the bill increases the responsibility of lenders so that the originator and the buyer of the loan can both be held responsible for any unscrupulous action by the loan's originator. We believe this bill will help protect those homeowners who may be considering a reverse mortgage to meet their needs and ensure a fair product that best meets their needs. We look forward to working with you in moving this important legislation forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Mr. Dahlheimer, it's a hard act to follow.
Yes,
is there anything to add?
Very hard, but I will match it with brevity, if that's not to be appreciated. Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Daryl Dahlheimer, and I'm a program director at Lutheran Social Service, the part of LSS in this state that does reverse mortgage counseling as part of its overall housing counseling, financial counseling product. We served last year 12,000 Minnesotans in housing and financial counseling, and I come here to ask for your support in this legislation, and my only value added here is to tell you three very brief scenarios from the actual front lines. That's maybe something that's missing in all the lobbying that happens both ways, some actual stories of ill seniors. And I want you to know that I chose these cases out of the several thousand we counsel in reverse mortgage counseling to be typical cases as opposed to extravagant ones. So number one, we had a senior couple in their 60s who were brought to our counseling agency for reverse mortgage counseling to get their certificate of counseling, brought by their financial planner who had recommended a reverse mortgage for the purpose of taking out a lump sum investment from their house and investing the proceeds in the stock market with him. I hear the laughter, and that's appropriate. Reverse mortgage counseling, as appropriately done, helped them understand that while it was their decision, the interest charges alone that would accrue on a reverse mortgage taken would need to be at least matched by some kind of investment return, and that any time you put money in the stock market, it's potentially much more dangerous than your home, and you're transferring risk. So in this particular case, it was one where we saw a wildly inappropriate referral, and we let the senior have the full picture. The second case I'd like to share is a senior who is a widow who talked to a reverse mortgage lender, asked some questions. This is actually a pretty sharp senior. Asked some questions because they thought, well, I have to pay interest on that reverse mortgage proceed I take out, those monthly payments, right? And they were told that the credit line they would take out actually would pay them interest. Patently false, completely opposite, black equals white information. Nonetheless, without reverse mortgage counseling from a neutral, nonprofit, HUD-approved agency, would have been the only information this senior had. And the third situation was a client who was brought, actually, to the appointment by an insurance agent. She was a fairly lonely widow, isolated in her home, brought by the insurance agent who had befriended her, and who actually had encouraged her to take out a reverse mortgage for the purpose of taking the lump sum to invest in an annuity, which is a life insurance product, at commission with this life insurance agent. I'm telling you, these are common practices we come across, and that's why we really believe reverse mortgage counseling needs to be there for all seniors, for all reverse mortgage products, to provide a necessary counterweight to the hard sell, financially driven, that happens in the industry so often. I finally want to suggest that these three seniors were lucky because they found out that there was neutral information to be had. As the law currently stands, only seniors seeking a HECM reverse mortgage are given this protection. All other reverse mortgages are open in the Wild West for no information, no protection for our seniors. This bill would remedy that. We have a chance to get ahead of predatory lending before it hits the reverse mortgage industry. Thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else desires to testify? Please come on down. Welcome. If you'd just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, I'm Beth Patterson, and I'm with Prestige Mortgage, Reverse Mortgages SIDAC. I've specialized in reverse mortgages for the last 10 years, and I am known as the expert in the industry in the state of Minnesota. I've done hundreds of loans through the years, including the HUD HECM product as well as proprietary products when they were available. Currently, there are no proprietary products, and there haven't been for at least the last year, and we're not hearing any word of them coming back in anytime soon. All HECMs, which stands for Home Equity Conversion Mortgage, are insured by HUD, and With my experience, all of our loans have been insured with HUD if they are the HECM, and I have had no rescission where people have backed out during the rescission period. I've written books, and I am worked very closely as an advocate for seniors, including working with the advocacy organizations as well as adult protection. Reverse mortgages have made a difference in the lives. I get calls from my borrowers that I did loans even 9-10 years ago that still call me and tell me what a difference they made. Restrictions of this bill will destroy reverse mortgages in Minnesota. Because of some of the restrictions, the lenders will just decide it's too hard to do and they'll just walk out of the state. And it, my understanding is nobody wants them to go away. We just want to protect the seniors so that they're not being taken advantage of. And I totally support that. HUD and RESPA do both have regulations in place for both the HECM as well as the proprietary products. And all of the proprietary products, when they were in place, were modeled after the HECM. From the counseling to the application and the disclosures, they were all the same, as well as the closing documents. My concerns are payments and repayment sections. That really does need to be removed. That hasn't been talked about very much, but with it saying that the balance cannot exceed 80% of the appraised value at the inception of the loan, that does not meet the reverse mortgage terms. Many of our loans right now already at the inception actually exceed the 80%. And our concern is that this is setting it up for risks of lawsuits. And I can work with authors or others to go into more details on that. Counseling is required for HUD, and I support, and actually when proprietary products were done, they did require counseling, and I do support adding that counseling for any proprietary products are required in the state of Minnesota, and that they should be done by HUD counselors trained on proprietary products. Lender default and forfeiture. The lender does not service the loans, and that can be a conflict. What I've been told is absolutely not. If that stays in, the reverse mortgage lenders will walk away. I am getting more confirmation on that from compliance departments. Lender responsibility. The originator's employer is responsible and should be responsible for the acts of the originator. The lender, some of the big lenders, if they are called responsible for what is done for advertising and what is done for what an originator says, will make it difficult. Lenders do have agreements with any correspondence with somebody who we sell our loans to that outline responsibilities. Right of rescission, even a 10-day rescission period will make this very, very difficult. And I know the concerns is that the borrowers have time to review the information, and actually they do. This is a mortgage transaction, and it takes a while in order to get it processed. Generally, it takes 30 or more days from the time of counseling or application through the process to closing, and they still, of course, have this 3-day rescission period. And the borrowers can cancel any time during that process. The loans will not fund until after rescission period. And anything longer than 3 days will be affected. What will be affected is the interest rates and how they are done. And that's going to affect the amount that is available to the borrowers, making it probably more costly. And investors may require higher margins to cover their increased potential. Managing payoffs is going to be more difficult, even with a 10-day rescission. Foreclosure issues, sometimes we only have a certain time frame to get that previous loan, especially if it's in a share sale or in foreclosure, turned around. So that would make it difficult. When property taxes are due, getting those through timely. Another risk is judgments or liens could be placed on the property or on the person during the rescission period. So so that's going to increase the liability of title companies, and they are likely to increase their title insurance, which would, of course, be passed on to the borrowers. We don't want that. Property insurance, when that is due and who is holding the responsibility while this is in process. So all of this would impact the timing. And one of the other things is when the lenders are purchasing the loans, from the investor to get HUD to insure it and all of that, there's a really short time frame, and the 10-day rescission period would have a big impact on that, and that's where the lenders may just decide it's too difficult and decide they're not going to do reverse mortgages here. Suitability is not black and white. Income, assets, and credit are not required on the reverse mortgage, and the reverse mortgage is a non-recourse loan. Now, I do agree that the counselors should make borrowers aware of other options that may be in place. They do have a tight protocol that they have to follow, and I agree in adding the proprietary products if when, and when they come back to have to follow that requirement and receive that information also.
Ms. Patterson, are you about ready to round out your...
I am. Real quick here. Thank you. The application and closing documents, at application we are required to give sample closing documents, so they get a lot of time and all of the information to review that. And then cross-selling, I agree with that wholeheartedly, that that should not be the same person as anybody who is originating or selling insurance products. And then my suggestions in addition to those changes is testing and licensing for anybody originating a reverse mortgage. And that will help protect seniors and making that list of those people available to the to the public.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. And I see we've been joined by one other person not on the list who's undoubtedly going to be very brief.
Extremely brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be extremely brief. I know you have a very aggressive agenda here. My name is Matthew Lemke, for the record. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. I'm here on behalf of the Mortgage Bankers Association, and at the outset, I will say we appreciate working with the author. We'll continue to do so on some of the changes, and as I said in the division committee, I'm very confident that I think we can come up with a solution on this bill that will protect seniors and not eliminate the product from the market at the same time. Just in the way of brevity, I'd like to say I agree with many of the things that were said by Lutheran Social Services on the counseling provision. I think that the counseling provision is probably the most important piece of this bill, and we strongly support many of the issues in the counseling provision. In fact, all of them, and I won't go through those again at this time. I'll just say Ms. Patterson, I believe, pointed out many of the issues that we still have with the bill as far as the cross-selling and the suitability provisions, probably the two main sticking points that we still have, but we'll continue to work with the authors as bill goes forward. Thank you for letting me testify. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Mr. Lemke. Thank you, Ms. Patterson.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to the bill? Are there questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Zeller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lemke, just maybe for him one quick question before we go, just to get it on the record here, because I think it is one of the important provisions, the 30-day cancellation period, for folks who are maybe got lost in the testimony, folks who are looking to get these funds, if there's a 30-day waiting period, right, of cancellation, the folks won't be able to access the money, correct?
Correct.
Mr. Lemke? Yes, Mr. Lemke, the question is Patterson. Mr. Lemke?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, it's been amended down to 10, which we appreciate some of the movement. However, we'd still like that to coincide with the federal 3-day truth in lending rescission period. My understanding is the reality of the way these products operate, the time frame, I think you can lock in for approximately 60 days on a rate. We're worried that even with the 10 days, you might push up against that time. So that's why we'd like to see that down to 3 days. However, we do think the 10 is better than 30.
Thank you, Mr. Lemke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for the amendment got to us late, so I apologize.
Good clarification. We actually have not yet adopted the amendment, the H528A101 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, the amendment does prevail. Further comments? If not,
thank you.
Carol renews motion that House File 528, Representative Dabney will renew his motion that House File 528 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Davin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Folks, we now have House File 680 before us. That is Representative Kalin's bill. It came to us in the House file before us. It needs to be amended. Representative Zellers, Ms. Newman, I believe, showed you the fashion. Just as bills travel from committee to committee, we've got to make sure that we're acting on the correct copy. So my understanding from Ms. Newman is that the appropriate motion is to move House File 680. We'll then to put it into the shape that the author desires to proceed with it, and to put it in shape that it's been traveling recently, would move to amend House File 680 as follows, which is to delete everything after the enacting clause and insert the language from H0680UE1. That will then put it up to date, and then there's the author's A9 amendment, which we'll do next. But all in favor of the motion to amend to delete everything after the enacting clause and adopt the UE1, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? There being none, that motion prevails. The chair will then move the A9 amendment to put it in the shape with which the author would like to proceed. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, Representative Kalin, your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And
as you know, Representative Kalin, you can limit your comments purely to the jobs/commerce piece, so I expect it will be relatively brief and easy. Thank you.
Happy to do so. I do want to, before diving into the substance of the bill, thank staff for making sure that we have the correct version before us. The bill before you, House File 680, is a green jobs bill to put Minnesotans to work. By allocating the federal recovery dollars that are coming to the Office of Energy Security. Some of you may not know that the Office of Energy Security is essentially the state energy office, renamed by Governor Pawlenty within the Department of Commerce. The bill has three main sections dealing with weatherization, an existing program receiving about a 12-time greater expenditure to weatherize low-income homes for Minnesotans around the state. There are currently 400,000 income-eligible households, of which we only can serve 165,000 and only weatherize 3,800 of those. The other portion of the bill is renovating our public buildings, our schools, city halls, county government centers, and our state government buildings. And then the last portion, section 7 and 8, are the training and reporting requirements to make sure that the bill works smoothly and that the programs work smoothly. For instance, we are moving from about that 3,800 low-income homes to weatherize to approximately 20 to 30,000, depending on how ultimately the community action agencies use those funds. The cap, as we call the community action programs, the CAPS have told us that within 28 days of passing the bill, they can be hiring new crews out in the field. We also believe within 30 to 45 days of passage of the bill, we can have electricians in our city halls and state government buildings. You probably heard the term shovel ready more than you care to over the last 3 or 4 months. With these jobs, shovels aren't needed as wrenches and basic tools. Diagnostic tools. So, Mr. Chair, the portion that you and I have discussed a great deal is Section 2, which are the guiding goals or principles for the Office of Energy Security. And I'd like to mention one item that we just deleted from the previous Section 2, and that is the reference to living wage. It was a concern that Chair Clark added in her committee with an amendment. We have since learned that Section 1606 of the Federal American Recovery and Reinvestment Act requires that every project funded by a single dollar of the stimulus funds be covered by prevailing wage, and it is the federal prevailing wage because these are federal dollars. To be honest, this is slightly new territory because I don't think we've had this great amount of residential projects covered by prevailing wage in Minnesota before. But
Our friends who deal with the prevailing wage a lot have told us that they're able to handle it and make sure the paperwork works. I will point out, Mr. Chair, that in Section 8 as well, we did delete line 3, which is the average wage of jobs created, because, of course, the prevailing wage, that is part and parcel of the requirements, dealing with all the prevailing wage issues, and median wages are will be reported. There is a critical component for me, lastly, Mr. Chair, my last point is in Section 8, the accountability and transparency reporting. It's really critical that we know that these programs and these funds are working, that they're resulting in job creation, they're resulting in good jobs, and that they're resulting in energy savings or renewable energy progress in the state. I expect, Mr. Chair, that you'll be a part, and this committee will be a part of ensuring that that these funds work. And as you might know, the new White House Special Advisor for Green Jobs, Enterprise, and Innovation, Van Jones, was in Minnesota two weeks ago, being appointed, and he specifically pointed to Minnesota as one of five states that he is looking to move as quickly as we can to deliver these jobs and to show that the green economy is a win-win-win across the board. So with that, Mr. Chair, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. And the bill is, I was actually able to see one of the earliest iterations of it. You've done a nice job in bringing it this far. It's improved quite a bit. Appreciate that. Representative Oppie had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we already adopt the A9 amendment?
We have.
To the UE1?
We have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there other questions or concerns? Representative Mullery?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this, I think, would probably be for staff. Could we require Minnesota prevailing wage on this, or are we limited to federal?
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, the state prevailing wage would only apply to state money, and this is exclusively federal money that Representative Kalin still is dealing with.
Mr. Chair, I understand all that. My question was whether we could.
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, we could, yes. We could change the law.
Representative Mullery? Thank you. Other questions or concerns relative to House File 680? Otherwise, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 680 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance for the recommended referral to the Committee on Energy Policy and Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
We have a couple bills. Okay, Representative Knuth has a bill. She's got a bill up in another committee right now. That means that the chair's bills are the only two that are left other than Representative Knuth. So, Representative Lilly, if you...
Mr. Chair, I was looking at your desk here, and I'm really surprised that you're going to pick Cal State Northridge to win it all. I don't know if you noticed the record 17 and 13, but...
Always go with the underdog. Stand up to the little guy, Mr. Chair.
I don't know much about basketball. I don't really quite understand the game, but... Mr. Chair.
That's what happens when hockey players take over the gavel. Mr. Chair and members, it's a little out of the norm, but so that we've got a bit of a roadmap for what we're going to do with the two charitable gaming bills, and I think people may already know this, but we've got House File 1511 and 1512. We are going to do 1512 first with a minor amendment to it, and then lay that bill over for inclusion in the subsequent bill, which is the department's bill. So I'd like to proceed with House File 1512. To begin with, I would move that bill for the potential inclusion in the omnibus charitable gambling bill, which will be next.
Chair Atkins moves House File 1512 be recommended to pass. And you have an author's amendment, sir?
Is that
PA3?
Yeah, there's an amendment. I don't unfortunately have it in my packet, but one of the special assistants to bring me this, the A3. That's my author's amendment. I'd appreciate support. I'd move the A3 amendment. Thanks, Joe.
Chair Atkins has moved the A3 amendments. Thank you, Representative Hoppe. That's very good teamwork there.
We're all in this together.
Thank you. Any questions regards to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Mm-hmm. Amendment adopted, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill then, this, the essence of this bill is that it allows for something called electronic bingo. Electronic bingo is not an expansion of gambling in Minnesota. Bingo is already allowed in Minnesota. What this provides for is it's sort of a 21st century version. You touch a screen rather than put a little dab on the board. The amendment provides for an allocation between the charitable organizations, the charity itself, the vendor, and the bars that provide the location where these devices would be installed. There's up to a half a dozen allowed to be used in a location. The most beneficial portion of that, in my opinion, in addition to the fact that the bars and vendor and charitable organizations all like this bill, is that it dramatically increases the amount that actually goes to the charitable cause. So little Johnny trying to get a trip to Valley Fair for the PTA or whatever actually gets 50 cents on the dollar. Currently it's 30, and this is a very, very significant increase in the amount that actually goes. In addition to that, they're much easier and cheaper to audit. They're easier and cheaper to run. You can know immediately whether or not there's a problem. There's a whole lot of advantages, not the least of which from the world of the charitable gambling managers, you don't have to store hundreds and thousands of pull tabs in rooms. All of this is able to be covered electronically. That's the essence of the bill. With that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions or concerns.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Any questions? Chair Atkins, we have a gentleman out in the crowd that raised his hand. Do you want that now, or do you want it...
If it's for this bill, Mr. Chair, absolutely.
Okay. Sir, come on up. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Rockler, and I'm the executive director of the Bowling Proprietors and the Tavern League. I guess in the interest of full disclosure, I represent licensed beverage associations that have all alcohol-related businesses with a couple of instances. I actually concur with 99% of the bill, and I agree that the charities really need this. My only question, though, is on point 7, if I understand that correctly, he would be allowing machines into non-licensed establishments. And I guess I'm curious as to how any minor control would take place in a convenience store where, from the best of my knowledge, if it's a non-licensed establishment, you can have 16 and 17-year-old kids working the counter there. So I don't know if I'm objecting or not. I guess I'm interested in hearing how that was going to be controlled.
Thank you, sir. Chair Atkins?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I do have the folks on the front lines that helped me with the draft of the bill. If either Mr. Barrett or Mr. Wilson or whomever that might be better than me taking a guess at exactly how it would be carried out, these folks actually do the front-line enforcement of these sorts of things. And I appreciate Mr. Rockley's question and support for the bill.
Mr. Barrett?
Happy St. Patrick's Day, ladies and gentlemen.
You're looking mighty fine there, sir.
The winner of this year's Masters Golf Tournament.
Please say your name and answer the question if you're...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tom Barrett, Director of the Gambling Control Board. And just to clarify a point, I'm sure that basketball sheet was not sports betting.
No, sir.
Okay, good. The in answer to his question, it is a concern regulatory, even with the machines that are out in bar locations now. Who's playing? By law, they have to be 18 years or over. The assumption, and working with the industry, if these devices, these pull-tab dispensing devices, were placed at non-liquor establishments, we would first require, similar to what's allowed to require in bars now, that those machines are within sight line, whoever's working the counter, whoever's managing the store.
to the point that when they have a prize receipt that they win, they're required, if it's $50 more, to sign that receipt. So if we have accusations, as we do now, where people, our best informants are players at other bars, they would notify us that, hey, we suspect this site is allowing minors to play, and we take action in that respect.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. I believe we have another gentleman I'd like to come forward. Is it Mr. Cahoon? Or?
Thank you, sir.
Please state your name and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Craig Cahoon, and I'm with Moss Distributing, and our office is in Bloomington. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Operators of Music and Amusements. That is a group of small businesses who buy the amusement devices and put them into locations throughout the state. Our association has 35 members that employ somewhere around 500 people, and again, their duty, their job is they buy the equipment and they provide to the locations on a revenue sharing basis, the bars and the restaurants and amusement locations throughout the state. These are businesses that have been, you know, very badly affected by the economy, but even more so by the recent smoking ban. And so these people are, their businesses have been affected quite a bit recently. And, you know, speaking here today on their behalf, not really in opposition to the bill, but to raise some awareness and bring up some concerns that we have. You know, obviously the idea of helping out the allied charities is a great cause, and everyone agrees with that, and we certainly do too. There's no doubt about that. One of the things, though, that we're concerned about is as you place these devices into these locations, a lot of the equipment that we've invested our capital in will be taken out of the locations, and this is something you may not be aware of. So we've invested a lot of money in machines that will be taken out of the locations and no longer be able to return the investment that has been made in those machines. The machines that would still stay in the locations would also have another problem, that is a lot of the attention to these amusement devices that we currently operate would be diverted to these new gambling machines that would be allowed in these locations, and the revenue would definitely drop. And again, we've already experienced revenue drops with smoking ban and economy and everything else, and I'm not quite sure that our industry can really withstand that type of a hit. The proposed business model that we have heard is for a single source, or maybe two sources, of out-of-state businesses that would provide these machines and take the majority, I've heard 70%, of the net revenue out of the state of Minnesota, while affecting negatively these businesses who have invested in this state and invested in their employees in this state for a number of years. These are family-owned businesses, small businesses that have been operating for a long time. We think it's a worthwhile cause, definitely. We would just like to raise awareness at this committee that it would have a very negative impact on businesses who have operated in this state for a long time, and ask that maybe there be some consideration, and I'm not sure legislatively or rules, that would involve our businesses in that program. Also, one thing that I want to point out, we have an office also in Iowa. We were involved in a video lottery program in Iowa. You may have heard of it, you may not have, and we invested a lot of money in it. The program was banned. What we did notice, just for verification of what we're talking about here, our amusement device income dropped approximately 35% when we implemented these machines into this program in Iowa. So again, I'm not sure that the businesses in Minnesota need to be negatively affected in order for this program to go forward. I think there should be some consideration that these businesses should maybe somehow be a part of this program.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cahoon.
Thank you very much.
Chair Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should point out that as far as the vendor, I think there is some misunderstanding that the vendor is going to get 70% of the net. It's actually in the amendment that you received. It's in the first year and second year when they're making the investment, it's 25 and 19%, and then it drops to 15% after that. So it's quite a bit less than that. I love these the guys that I'm like the world's worst golden tee player. So I make a huge investment in the amusement game device stuff at the various locations. But if there's a role for them to play, I'd like to be able to find it. And I pledge to you that we'll try to do that. I'm still getting my head around exactly how this is going to work. If there's a way to get them into it, and make it work for the charities, that would be an ideal situation to be in.
Chair Atkins, we have a question. Representative Anzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more of a point of clarification than it is a question. Amusement devices are not gambling devices. Amusement devices are not games of chance. And you got to be careful about trying to include a non-gaming device into a gaming device venue. So, just a little clarification. I, too, want them to survive, but they're in a different world.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions up here? Seeing none, Chair Atkins, do you want to...
Chair, I would, with the one final comment, that this bill and the next, the design here is to try to throw a lifesaver to a number of our charities that are suffering pretty heavily right now. I will also pledge to you that I don't intend to turn this into a vehicle for any sort of additional gambling. It's not going to be video pull tabs or other things in spite of what people may hope or desire. This is what it is. It's an electronic bingo provision that acknowledges bingo's legal in Minnesota. This is an update of how you play it. With that, I'd renew my motion that House File 1511 be recommended, actually be laid over as amended for potential inclusion in the omnibus charitable gambling bill.
Chair Atkins, is just a slight modification, is move that House File 1512 is laid on the table.
Yep, 1511 okay. Open. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Laid over. So, Chair Atkins, do you want to move House File 1511 then?
I do move House File 1511. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Atkins has moved House File 1511. So we have that bill before us. I understand there's some amendments to this. There's an A2 amendment.
An
A3. So do you want to start with
the A2, Mr. Chair? That both of these will put it into the shape that we want to proceed with it. Move the A2.
Does everybody have a copy of the A2 amendment? Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the A2, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? A2 is adopted. Everybody have a copy of the A3 amendment?
And Mr. Chair, just for clarification, the A3 amendment is the bill we just heard, folks. This is now to include the bill that was laid over, which is numbered 1512. We've now renumbered it as the 1511 A3 amendment, and I would move the A3 amendment.
Chair Atkins has moved the A3 amendment. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? A3 is adopted. We have your... bill as amended before us, and Representative Hoppe has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for you or for the author, I'm not sure. So we adopted the A2 amendment to 1512 and then adopted the A3 amendment, or to 1511, then we adopted the A3 amendment. How does that affect the A2 amendment? Was that part of the original bill? Did we delete that? Is that included?
I think we're Representative Hoppe. We can either go to Chair Atkins or Mr. McCormick can help us with.
I think Mr. McCormick could answer it more succinctly than I can, but it's my understanding it's in appropriate form.
Okay,
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, the author is correct. The A2 amendment amends the body of the bill, House File 1511. The A3 amendment adds a second article. Which contains the corpus of House File 1512.
Thank you very much, Mr. McCormick. I'm glad I didn't have to explain that. Any other questions, Mr. Hoppe? Chair Atkins, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd ask that Mr. Barrett from the Gambling Control Board, I won't recover the same ground that we just went through with the electronic bingo. This is the department's bill. It's fairly non-controversial, but it does kind of make a few things a little bit more straightforward than they currently are in law.
Thank you, Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, members, again, Tom Barrett, Director of the Gambling Control Board. Last legislative session, you directed the board to conduct a study. There are a number of issues that were facing the charitable gambling industry, and the results of this study, after seeking input from the industry regulators as well as our counterparts, Department of Revenue and Public Safety,
we incorporated many of the recommendations of focusing on the issues that were in the study into our policy bill. What's not in the policy bill is anything related to taxes. There's nothing in our policy bill related to the video machines that were amended later on. It does have significant provisions, allowances, supported by the industry in terms of removing what we call the expense calculation. This is the method that we would use as regulators to monitor the success or failure of a charitable organization. In light of the situation in economic times, we thought it was best to change the method of our evaluation and switch to a rate of profitability. In other words, what are you doing with the net proceeds and how is it getting to the bottom line in terms of youth, activity, veterans, and et cetera. So we're not losing focus of the expenses the organizations are achieving as part of the operation, but we're trying to focus on what are you doing with the money. The bill does allow provisions for what we call video enhancements, and I caution it's not a video lottery, not anything that has to do with the outcome of the game. It simply produces up on the video screen or a TV screen at the location of what the winning number was. There is penalty provision. We're one of the last agencies that still have a $500 citation limit. That goes back to 1986, and frankly, the industry supports that. If they don't pay the penalty, they're required to come in before the board. And there were also a small provision that on raffles. The law requires them to submit raffle requests to us within 30 days. Some organizations fail to do that. We still get the raffle permit out, but we found what we allow, we encourage. Well, we want to encourage them to give us a little more notice. In the bill is simply an added fee of $50 if they send it to us less than 30 days. We get to claim that. Is this summary?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Jackin?
That's all I got, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'm just answer questions or concerns.
Anybody else in the audience that'd like to be heard for or against this bill? Seeing none, any questions from members? Representative Hoppe, you told me you had 5 questions in the elevator.
For the next bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Any final comments, Chair Atkins?
No. Please pass the bill.
Okay. With that, Chair Atkins renews his motion that House File 1511, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill's on your way, sir. Representative Knuth. Representative Knuth moves that House File 362 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Representative Knuth, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a straightforward bill. Currently, in current law, a homeowner must give written notice in terms of a claim on a warranty. This is that there's actual notice, that they've talked about the issue, and there's some record of it that would be admissible in court if this were to be taken to court, and it's makes it a little more clear for the homeowner that it won't be thrown out if it's not their claim will not be thrown out if it's not in a prepared written way. In the era of phone calls and email and different ways of communication, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I have a testifier here who I appreciate sticking around to help answer any questions, and if he wants to make a few comments, that would be great.
No comments, just be available for questions if
there are. Mr. Jacob Berger, I have Michael Noonan on the list of folks that may have some comments. Welcome back, Mr. Noonan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Noonan. I am the Division President of Rotland Homes. I'm also a past president of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Builders Association of Minnesota. We would like to raise our objections to this bill as presently written, and specifically to the notion of deleting the provision for written notice. We believe there still is opportunity to work through the objections to come up with a bill that would address the concerns. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to provide some background to the members of the committee with respect to why we believe that written notice is so important. I think written it's important to understand that when we are dealing with warranty claims, we're dealing with two creatures. We're dealing with an initial claim or request for service provided by the homeowners, which is not in the legal arena, but is really in accordance with the notice and opportunity to repair to allow the two parties to work out to address the situation and come to an amicable situation. I think a written notice throughout provides clear and unequivocal understanding of what is at issue and provides no uncertainty with respect to what is being expected or what is being asked for by the various parties. To suggest that there are other means of communication rather than the written word creates a whole sorts of problems. You run into the classic situation of I said, she said, he said, we said, they said, you know, and you get the situation where it gets all muddled and confused. I think the written word is very powerful, and it's very clear in terms of what the expectations are at the front end. Now, in terms of if a situation cannot be appropriately addressed in an amicable fashion and in an appropriate fashion between a homeowner and a builder, then I think we're into a different situation, and we're into the situation where legal action is the unfortunate set of circumstances that have to result, and that has a whole standard of care and standard of notice associated with it. But to suggest that the discussions which really deal with the rudimentary and the routine service calls where both parties are attempting to resolve the issue serves as a notice for future legal instances, I think that's misleading, and it may prove as a disincentive for the parties to work together to amicably resolve it in accordance with the notice and opportunity to repair. So I would urge that we return to the notion of including written notice. I think it's only fair. I think it avoids all sorts of confusion and provides for a measure of precision that otherwise would be lacking. And with that, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Noonan. Are there questions for Mr. Noonan at this point? Mr. Jacobberger, you wanted to make a comment as well, and we'll take questions from members of the committee. Mr. Jacobberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't aware that there would be strong opposition due to the lack of written notice. I want to make a couple of comments. The written notice as it's now practiced is really a trap for the unwary. Many, many of our clients simply pick up the phone and call their contractor. They have a relationship with the contractor. They don't feel a necessity to send him a written notice. And very often, the contractor responds, and there's an interplay between the contractor and the client that goes on for a period of time, neither one of them really being aware of the written notice provision. But when it gets into litigation, suddenly our people get trapped, frankly, by the fact that they never gave written notice to that contractor. And there are cases, even in the Court of Appeals now, that confirm that, some that are pretty egregious, where the contractor and the plaintiff homeowner have dealt together for weeks and even months at a time. And there's absolutely no question both are aware of what's going on. And yet the courts look at the law and say, it says written, it means written. We can't do anything about it. The 6 months expired. That's what we need relief from, and that's the purpose of this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobberger. Representative Hoppe, you had a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author.
Okay.
Representative Knuth, we have a lot of these bills. We've heard a number of them today, and this seems pretty simple and straightforward. Is this meant to be, and I'm not questioning motives, I'm just wondering, is this potential for this becoming a vehicle for any other bills, Representative Swales' bill dealing with attorney's fees, or Representative Gardner's bill dealing with property damages cap in particular?
Representative Knuth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, that's not my intention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Representative Zeller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and not for the author of the testifier, but I'm going to renew my old argument again. We're in 327A. Unfortunately, Representative Dabney's heard this speech too many times.
Mr. Chair, it seems to always be on my bill as well.
Thank you.
I've heard it several times, too.
Representative Dabney, we wish you would.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear it from you instead of
Representative Dabney.
The floor, I think. At this point, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't matter, but we're in...
How about if we just say duly noted, Representative Zeller?
So well, we actually added two, so I want to make sure it's on the record. We're in 0.01, 0.02, 0.03, 0.01 again, 0.02 again, 0.04, 0.06, 0.07, and 0.08 in the same 328-7A section. I understand Representative Obermueller's got a bill that has the non-controversial, the stuff that people can live with. Rather than gum up the process, the committee time, and Representative Dabney's time hearing bill after bill after bill that may or may not survive, really wish we could just do the short and simple version, but Mr. Chairman, I will defer to your knowledge on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Zellers, and thank you, Representative Knuth, for the assurance relative to the lack of vehicular nature of the bill. Are there other questions, comments, concerns? If not, the Representative Knuth will renew her motion that House File 362 be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you all very much. Folks, that concludes our agenda. I'll remind you, this is not sports betting. This is just the chair putting up some kind of, I think I'm going to buy pizza for the winner. So if you want to bet on orange on your NCAA March Madness pool or whatever, make sure you do that. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you for your patience this evening.
Enumerating